couple of weeks. The formal printed version will be available in a couple of weeks. As you know, this is really the culmination of this comprehensive review of programs in Afghanistan, and we'd especially like to start by thanking IOM for the International Organization for Migration for their help in preparing this report. In particular, Stephen Lennon, Dana Graber, Matt Huber, Brian Kelly, and Beth Dunlap, although many, many others at IOM, in particular in Afghanistan, were most helpful. Clearly, we would not be here without their support, but also without the continuing support of our core funders, the Hewlett Foundation, the United Nations Foundation, the Better World Fund, the Carnegie Corporation of New York, and the Ford Foundation, who really allow us to pursue the development of models that we hope will improve the practices of the world, the United States, and the international community in these post-conflict places. I want to say the thanks for our entire team, because they're all running around still, and there's a later moment where I can thank them for what they have done. But clearly, this has been a huge team project. We have not totally refined how to take this much information and make it an easy job yet, but we are learning as we go along. So we said the first version, the Iraq report, was sort of the Model T. This will hopefully be maybe a couple decades beyond the Model T, but it still has an awful lot of labor that's involved in producing this kind of work. So the first place to start is, why did we do this work? I mean, why this report now? I think it all starts fundamentally with a core problem in post-conflict reconstruction. Many, many practitioners in post-conflict settings have been concerned for some time with the measurement of progress, and for a lot of reasons. It's been generally the reporting and the measures have been dominated by the money that's been spent, by the projects that have been completed, and somehow we have situations where 100 successful projects do not equal one successful country. And so that's the starting point. We also have built our measurements in the past on unreliable data, on rumor-filled anecdotes. We have found that the measures have not been particularly integrated. They seldom take the view of the local people. They're usually from the view of the donors or other participants. The information that was used and the conclusions that you reached were very much dependent on the sources that were used. It has been way too unwieldy for the average policymaker or for the operators on the ground to find it convenient or helpful, and it has been just plain out of balance. So those were all weaknesses that we hoped to address with the refinement of this model. We also found that in general, the work was rather weak, although people saw it as being terribly important. It didn't have a very significant place in the actual operations. And so what we tried to do was to build a model that would essentially address these weaknesses. The second reason we did this at this point is that Afghanistan is the second largest case in recent history, and we'd done some initial work on Afghanistan, and it appeared to be at a pivotal moment, so we thought that was critically important. And this judgment finally was confirmed by the people who were working on the case, that this was a time that Afghanistan should be looked at. So we're pleased to present our method and the findings and some recommendations, and Morgan will take us through some of the methodology that we've used, and then we'll come back and talk about the findings and the recommendations.
All right, to start, to give you guys an outline of our presentation today, we're going to start with the methodology, continue with the findings, move to recommendations, and then finally conclude. So first with the methodology, all of the post-conflict reconstruction project's work centers on four pillars, which we've modified here for five pillars. First, security, then governance and participation, justice and accountability, economic opportunity, and social well-being, with the understanding that all of these things are interlinked and success in one is dependent on success in all of the others. Moving from that, we have done this model. We've used this model in Iraq, and now we're moving to Afghanistan. This is how we've decided to split up our regional analysis, with actually the central region, Bamiyan, included in the north, That's of note. And Ghazni, which is generally known as the southeast, groups with the south. Now, in general, our methodology stems from the confusion that often arises in post-conflict areas, which is that you have quantitative information and qualitative information, and you have no idea how the reconstruction's actually going. So you have public sources, which we define as government sources, NGOs, organizations like that, which say thousands of courthouses have been built, which is great. And then you have media reports, which say, which quote an Afghan as saying, well, I don't trust judges, they're completely corrupt. Okay, that's clearly bad. So how do you know how the justice sector is actually doing? Now, what we endeavored to do here was bring all the information that we could collect from January 2004 until June 2005 and look at it and synthesize it and figure out how the reconstruction effort is going. So we bring three unique elements to this methodology. First, an unbiased perspective. So using public sources, media sources, interviews we've conducted on the ground, interviews that we trained Afghans to conduct on the ground, and all the polls that have been conducted in the country over the time frame that we examined, we tried to outweigh or weigh together all of the biases to get a more comprehensive and complete picture and a balanced picture. The second, incorporating local voices. It's absolutely crucial in any reconstruction effort that you consider the perspective of the people in question, because they are really the people on whom the success depends. So that's what we've done here. As I mentioned, we conducted interviews. I'll talk a little bit more about that. Finally, measuring what matters. As Rick was talking about, oftentimes we look at how the reconstruction effort is going in terms of long-term capacity. Building of courthouses, building of schools, restructuring of government ministries, which is certainly very important. But also important is the fact that you need to meet humanitarian needs in the immediate period. And so we decided to look at the data on both of those criteria. So whether short-term needs and interests of Afghans are being met, and whether the long-term capacity of the Afghan state and society have increased. And as I mentioned, we have a breadth of sources. So, as I mentioned, public media polls and surveys, CSIS conducted interviews, and Afghan conducted interviews. For public sources, we looked at 44 different governmental and non-governmental sources. For media, we looked at 48 different American, European, Asian, Arab, and Afghan news agencies. For polls and surveys, 13 different polls and surveys from different organizations. And then we also conducted, not my choice, conducted interviews with Afghans. CSIS staff from February to April 2005 went around the country to Kabul, Kapisa, Parwan, Ghazni, Mazar-e-Sharif, Kunduz, Panjshir, and Kandahar, and we did 112 interviews with 662 Afghans. Now, our interviews are a little bit more journalistic. We call them structured conversations, which means that we talk to one or a group of Afghans and lead an open-ended conversation so that they can take the conversation to the issues that are most important to them. So we ended up collecting a lot of quotes from that, which will be incorporated into our final report. But this was also, the ratings from these interviews were also incorporated in our data. Further, we trained Afghans to conduct interviews. They went all around the country, hitting 20 of 34 provinces, conducting over 1,000 interviews with over 1,600 Afghans. We did get a balance of women, and we did get interviewers from all over the country, and included women, female interviewers as well. So these are the different areas that that the interviewers reached. So this is CSIS interviews, and that includes where the Afghans reached. We believe that after all said and done, these graphs will show a visual snapshot of reconstruction progress. When the graphs come up, I'll show you that along the x-axis, we have long-term capacity of the government, so building up of that, and then along the y-axis, the meeting of Afghan needs.
I think what we've seen, just to give an overall impression, is that there's been huge progress, but there's an incredibly long journey ahead. We've titled the report In the Balance because we feel the country, the people, the reconstruction are all at that point where it's very much in the balance. We recognize that we're entering a new phase. The emergency is over. The needs that remain are still great. What we found in the report overall was that there are very different expectations. We're hopeful. The people are hopeful, but they want more, and they've got a rather realistic sense of what more looks like. There are a series of rather different operations required at this point. We have gone through the familiar humanitarian and war-fighting periods, and now we get to the more difficult transition period, which will be longer and probably tougher in many ways. We believe that it probably is going to take about 10 years. We say 10 years because that seems like a long time in the United States. The Afghans that we spoke to had that sense of a length of time that it would be required. And it's going to be tough, not just because of the size and the geography, the history, the practices, the desperate poverty, but the fact that they all converge so completely and so fully in Afghanistan. We also believe that it's going to be highly unpredictable, and there's just so much that can happen, and we should expect that many, many things will go wrong, and that you have to, whatever planning you put in place has to consider that. Clearly, as we talk to people, and I think you'll see as Morgan goes through some of the findings, that there's still ongoing concerns with crime, commanders, corruption, impunity. These are among the many concerns, but then also in terms of people are also thinking very much in terms of their own futures, the health, education, electricity, and local services. So all of those things show up very much in our findings, and I think Morgan will just walk us through individual sets.
So this is the big picture of how reconstruction is going in Afghanistan. Surprisingly, or perhaps not, security is in what we call the viable zone. So it actually, long-term capacity is being built up and security needs are largely being met. I will go over a little bit more detail in each of these pillars. And notably, justice and economic opportunity are not doing as well. A lot of Afghans still very, very poor. Poverty is a major concern in the country. And justice is extremely weak. The formal system is not very strong whatsoever. And the informal system seems to be much stronger, and the Afghans seem to trust it a lot more. The regional view, it appears that the north is doing the best of all the different regions, although Kabul and the capital area are making their way up. And the south and east, somewhat predictably, are in the what we call the danger zone. So long-term capacity not being built up to the same degree, and Afghan needs not being met. So for security, our top line finding was that the security situation has improved because of the international military presence, but crime remains a serious concern and commanders continue to wield significant influence. The indicators we looked at under security were commanders, insurgency, disarmament, demobilization, reintegration, Afghan National Army, Afghan National Police, international forces, and crime. So those are the results for security. Kind of hard to see from back in the back of the room, but ANA is doing the best on this graph, and commanders are the worst. So Afghans welcome the presence of international forces. They're providing security along the borders and throughout the country through provincial reconstruction teams. This is in part due to the fact that they have rapid response capabilities which can quickly defuse conflict if it arises. The Afghan National Army is a symbol of national unity and pride. It performs the best of the indicators, we believe, because billions of dollars have been pumped into it. Soldiers are now well paid, well trained, and have conducted successful missions. They are a symbol of pride in the country. For police, commanders still rule local areas, often through the Afghan National Police. Our data shows that demobilized militia are joining the police force and retaining loyalty to their former commanders. These former commanders are simultaneously being brought into the formal system, often as mayors and as police chiefs, which has served to legitimize these militias and weaken the ANP's reputation. For crime, crime is the chief security concern of Afghans, not the Taliban or Al-Qaeda. With large-scale clashes at a minimum, crime has emerged as a problem. Kidnappings, hijackings, extortion, lots of property issues are all problems with which Afghans have little recourse because they don't trust the police and the justice system is very weak. For governance, our top-line finding is that President Karzai is a positive symbol of national unity and hope, but the Afghan government remains weak. Commanders and corruption continue to obstruct the delivery of services and Afghans' democratic rights. The indicators we looked at in this section were central government, local governance, and political freedoms and participation. And for the central government, which is performing the best here, Afghans support the central government despite its inability to deliver services. They see Karzai as a national symbol, transcending ethnic lines, and as a respected leader on the world scene. For local governance, which is not doing as well, in fact, the poorest in this section, squarely in the danger zone, regional officials in our data were viewed as overwhelmingly corrupt and unresponsive to Afghan needs. This is the level that affects the day-to-day lives of Afghans. So they see more and they expect more from their local governments. Our data reports many instances of corruption, often stemming from the fact that regional governors, many of whom are former commanders, are appointed by the central government, and they appoint their friends as chiefs of police and as mayors. They're not accountable to the population, and there is a desire for more responsible technocrats in the government. Bribery is also a concern, as even low-level government workers are asking for bribes to supplement their low incomes, which average about $40 a month. This has led many Afghans to believe the government represents the needs of the wealthy and not of the poor. For political freedoms and participation, people were very, very happy about the presidential elections, and they look forward to the parliamentary elections. Political parties are forming, but the voting system that was chosen minimizes their influence and leaves voting open to intimidation and coercion by local commanders. There are also still social restraints preventing women from voting, and it is likely that there will be a resurgence of violence around the parliamentary elections to prevent people from voting. For justice, the formal justice system in Afghanistan remains unable to confront criminal networks, eliminate impunity, adjudicate land disputes, or protect citizens' rights. Afghans continue to rely on traditional methods that tend to be applied unevenly. Of all of the sectors, this is the one that performed the worst, which is a reflection of the few resources that the international community has invested in this sector. Afghans do not yet trust formal justice institutions, often preferring to seek recourse through traditional mechanisms like village councils. This can be attributed to the fact that the people are unfamiliar with the processes associated with the formal justice system, and that judges are viewed as corrupt, taking bribes from interested parties, and from commanders who have their interests at stake. Judges are also poorly paid when they are paid at all, making them susceptible to corruption. We looked at the justice system, rights protection, and impunity in this category. As you can see, none of the indicators is performing particularly well. For rights protection, Afghans enjoy more political, economic, and social rights now than any time in the past three decades. But the status of women remains low, and land issues remain unresolved. People are voting, girls are returning to school, there is freedom of speech, and a relatively independent media. Women have increased freedom of movement, but land issues remain a significant problem. There have been land courts that have been set up that are weak. People don't go to them, and this has not been adequately addressed by the international community. Land titles are few and far between, and 80% of civil cases are related to land issues. Afghans remain cynical toward the formal justice system because commanders and war criminals operate with impunity. The police are often made up of former militiamen, and their police chiefs are often re-hatted commanders, which makes apprehension and trial of criminals very difficult. As mentioned before, judges are also susceptible to bribery, making the judicial process weak and unreliable. Without punishment for criminals, commanders will not be deterred from continuing criminal practices. In addition, former commanders have now assumed positions within the government, Governor Atta, Minister Khan, etc. This has served to reduce Afghans' trust in the government. Economic growth has been significant but uneven. Commanders still maintain illicit sources of revenue, and job opportunities are lacking for most Afghans, including ex-combatants. Afghans are getting by, but they are vulnerable, and income is unpredictable. This pillar was also in what we call the danger zone, or the lower left quadrant, which means the capacity is not being sufficiently built up, and Afghan needs are not being met. Most Afghans are living on less than $2 a day, and government salaries are low when they're paid. This has particularly been a problem for those people whose integrity is essential for the functioning of the government, particularly police, who average $30 a month, judges, who average $36 a month, and other government workers who average $40 a month. Teacher salaries are also devastatingly low. The poppy point here was actually particularly interesting because poppy cultivation is seen here as being detrimental to government capacity, but meeting needs, as you could imagine. So poppy production has actually dropped this year, surprisingly, but it's unclear whether this is due to the fact that President Karzai has banned poppy production, or whether this is due to drug lords controlling their interests. Last year, the bumper poppy crop caused prices to plummet, and it may be that they want to raise the prices of poppy this year. Finally, for economic climate, it's performing the best of the indicators in this section. And there have been a lot of laws that have been passed, and the economy continues to grow. Foreign investment remains low. Economic growth was about 7.5% for 2004-2005. But the government strategy for building up the economy was predicated on lots of foreign investment, and there has been less than expected. And this is largely due to the limited availability of power and water, which foreign businesses require in order to operate. Our final pillar was social well-being, and services have improved significantly, but they are difficult to access and quality remains mediocre. We looked at healthcare and nutrition, repatriation and shelter, infrastructure and communication, education. Yes, those are the four. I don't quite know why we have more than that on the screen, but now for social well-being. Communications are greatly improved in all urban areas and in some rural areas. Most electricity is provided by generators, and the vast majority of Afghans do not have power. Rehabilitation of irrigation systems has not met immediate needs and has not received the attention it needs for the longer term. There have been isolated successes in the transportation sector, but lack of roads is preventing Afghans' access to markets, healthcare, and education. Children are returning to school, but teachers are unqualified and schools are difficult to access. The healthcare system suffers from poor infrastructure, access, and a lack of trained doctors. And Afghans are returning to their country by the millions, causing increased strain on services that are already stretched.
In terms of the recommendations, what we started with, as usual, is to try to suggest what a realistic goal is, something that's achievable, something that we think is still ambitious, but is the right place to try to direct our efforts. And what we really settled on was something, a rather straightforward statement. Afghans should have a chance to build their skills, make a living, connect to each other in the world, and establish an open government under the rule of law. If we are successful in doing that, what would Afghanistan look like in 10 years? It would still be a desperately poor country with a young population, but unified and working to build a safe and prosperous future. We think that is realistic. We think you have to think in those terms and really be looking at a 10-year period. The context we are in is one where we will face many, many problems, but we believe they're surmountable if we stay focused on the large, important questions. Right now, 90% of Afghanistan's budget is supported by donors in the United States. Alone is spending about $15 billion per year. We expect that the international assistance will steadily drop over the coming decade, but the fact that will be less damaging if those cuts are not made in a dramatic fashion, if it's something that people could actually plan on. What we've tried to do in our report is to offer five guiding principles that we feel will help with whatever recommendations follow. And the five guiding principles are rather straightforward. First, the international forces must guarantee Afghan security for the next decade. It's unlikely that, no matter how well things go with the new Afghan army and the new Afghan police, that they will be totally self-sufficient. Secondly, we believe the international financial assistance has got to move much more quickly into the hands of ordinary Afghans. And that will mean doing some things that we're not comfortable doing right now, such as paying salaries. We've found a way to pay the salaries of the new Afghan military, but we are chronically opposed to doing that when we are thinking in terms of civilians. The third principle that we put forward is the Afghan government and international donors must look beyond Kabul for reliable partners in local government and civil society. This is not a pro or anti-Kabul position. It's a reality of the country position. That it's going to be very, very hard for Kabul to reach out in a country where travel, communications, and just knowing what's going on in the provinces is as difficult as it is. Obviously, the president has an advantage right now because he is able to appoint the governors, and that's quite a strength that needs to be used probably more effectively. The fourth principle that we put forward is that international assistance must focus on freeing Afghans from the burden of time-consuming survival strategies by providing economic efficiencies that will improve productivity. Right now, anybody who's visited Afghanistan realizes that a huge majority of the people spend the majority of their time in survival activities, getting from one place to another, spending several hours of a day trying to figure out how to stay warm or whatever is required. So there are very, very few efficiencies, and that has to be at the heart of it. And the fifth guiding principle is Afghan leaders must convince fellow Afghans that working together as citizens of a shared community is the only viable path to safety and prosperity. It has been an atavistic environment. People have shown how resourceful they are. Some of that resourcefulness has obviously been used to just plain survive, sometimes at the cost of their neighbors and friends. This feeling of a national spirit is absolutely central to any long-term success, and something that really has to be built from inside. It's not going to be something that we're going to be able to exhort with our rhetoric. So that gets us really to the recommendations that we've made, and what we've really tried to do with these recommendations is, in a place like Afghanistan, as in most post-conflict places, whatever you do has to have multiple benefits. You don't have enough time, you don't have enough money to be able to do just one-offs. You can't take on the 100 opportunities that are presented. You have to be much more focused. And when you undertake something, it does have to achieve several results at the same time. So these recommendations are reflective of things that are going on in the country, but perhaps putting them together in this way will suggest a more integrated pattern that we highly recommend and feel is going to be necessary to be successful. And the first one really focuses on key border crossings and those regions around them, because our feeling is that the strongest commanders, warlords, have grown up around those four major border crossings, where they were able to secure customs funding for their own operations, where they were able to build up their own governing structures. And so we feel that really breaking that grip is a place to start in terms of dealing with the commanders. But we also think that you get additional benefits from doing that. We believe that it's a place where the Afghan National Army can initially be deployed and really meet some fair tests. We believe that you could also start to pay some of the civil servants there adequately so they can't be as subject to corruption. We think that this is a place to really test whether you can deliver services to the local governors. So rather than thinking in terms of all 34 provinces simultaneously, we think that this is the place to start and then to move into the other areas at that point. We do believe that governors are going to be the key, again, because of the infrastructure weaknesses and the historical weaknesses of trying to run from the center, even though we agree fully with those who think that there needs to be a credible center, but just don't count on it to do too much is what we're saying. Our second recommendation discusses how we're going to strengthen the connections between Afghans, and clearly there is a huge infrastructure gap here in the country. We believe that roads and water in particular, is not just for irrigation, but also water, because we saw a number of micro hydro projects that were incredibly effective and valuable for the local people, and we're starting to gain some of the efficiencies that we talked about before. Clearly, communications has improved immeasurably because of the cell phones that many people have around the country, something that didn't exist just a short while ago. But we also think that the road projects probably need to be thought through to maximize the reach of the number of people rather than building on too much more symbolism. We think the first road that was built had a significant communications connection value, but it also had a huge symbolic value. But the next set of roads probably need to all be, we need to minimize the symbolism and we need to maximize the connectivity to the population. In a way that suggests that some of the existing mechanisms can be used as well to reduce some of the divisions within the society. And our third recommendation is one which speaks to target populations and to their great needs. You have to make the people of Afghanistan, give them the opportunity to be competitive in a region which is increasingly economically prosperous, but they cannot be left in a position of being not having the skills to be part of that region. And the best way to do that is to focus, since this is an extremely young country, we suspect much younger than the demographics, than the census figures that are used by the international community suggest. We believe that a place to focus is on youth and on women, because these are really going to be the change agents for the society. But to do that, you're going to have to anchor the middle class that's going to provide the services, because it's never going to be done by the international community, and it's not going to be done out of Kabul. So you have to look at these key change agents, teachers, judges, police, and others who will provide the enabling environment. And they will have to be paid, or they're not going to be able to stay in these jobs. And without them, it's unlikely that these services will ever be delivered. So what we've tried to do is to look at, provide three recommendations that show you that this is an integrated challenge, and you can't just come at it by biting off one piece or another piece. You really have to think of it as little holes, and we hope that they come together in a way. We think this. We think they will come together in a way that will make this future that we've described possible over these next 10 years. What we've tried to do with this report, and again you'll see it in greater detail and with charts for virtually everything, is to provide a baseline that if we revisit in 6 months or in a year, you will be able to see how things are moving in Afghanistan. One of our core contentions is if you don't have a baseline, if you don't know where you're starting, it's pretty difficult to know whether you're going in the right direction or whether you're moving. So that's really what is at the core of this model, and we hope that you've gotten a little bit of a chance to get a taste of it in this presentation. And what we'd like to do is to spend the remaining 45 minutes taking your questions, comments, suggestions, and having a full discussion. In doing that, I'd like to invite two other key members of the team, and the whole team is key. So maybe what I should do before I invite the two other members to come up is to introduce the team. I think they're all, is everybody in the room now, pretty much? Is anybody hanging out outside there? Still being modest? Well, why don't we start with, I see Craig Cohen. If everybody knows, Craig has been a really valuable editor and did not travel with us to Afghanistan, but has really brought great perspective to this. And I see Leora Danan standing next to, who's been an intern in our office up until just a little while ago, and now she's on our staff. Seema Patel, who's an intern from the Fletcher School for the summer. It's been incredible. I see Mark here, Mark Irvin, who's here as a summer intern from Boston College. Is Mike around? He's upstairs? Okay. And then Jenny Urisar, who was an intern here for the summer, just left on Friday, is not with us. And Rebecca Lindner, many of you have seen, who did the voices of New Afghanistan, the report on the interviews. She's away on vacation as well. And then critically, and at the center of a lot of our work, even though she's now working at the United Nations, is Sheba Crocker, who's been my co-director, served as a final editor of this, was with us in Afghanistan, and is very much a co-leader of this particular project. So I'd like to invite up two of the other main authors, I guess, if you'd come up now. Hugh Riddle, who was an intern with us for the past several months and is going to be working at the World Bank, and John Ewers, who's been a military fellow here at CSIS. They helped us in different parts of this report, and we just thought it'd be good for you to hear their voices as well as we take your questions and comments. So I think we have, at this point, we should have some microphones around that... If you could just wait for a second, because there is an audio track, and does our audio, do you have something, some directions you want to give us? Or do you have the first question? Okay. All right. Well, why don't you just raise your hands, and we'll bring a microphone to you. But thank you very much.
Hi, thank you. Stuart Patrick, Center for Global Development. Had a couple questions. The first is on, I used to work at the State Department until early February, and in terms of metrics, you know, the administration is quite obsessed with them, as most people know, but I would agree that in most cases what is being measured are inputs as opposed to impact. So I applaud this effort. First question is, have you ever... had any briefings with the folks who actually put together the metrics for the Afghan Interagency Operations Group, because they do collect them on a pretty regular basis, and I think that would be a useful thing. A couple more issues. One of them is on the reconciliation and justice component. One of the big debates in dealing with Afghanistan has been over the degree to which one tries to co-opt the warlords, and now indeed in some cases co-opting members of the Taliban leadership. And there's trade-offs, obviously, between the short-term stability that buys you and the long-term need for justice for a sustainable peace. And that didn't come up in, you know, when Morgan was discussing that piece. So I'd like to know whether or not you had a general sense as to whether or not what people thought about either having a Truth and Reconciliation Commission or some sort of war crimes tribunal, as opposed to simply letting sleeping dogs lie. And then the final question is just about the regional dimensions. There's, you know, you made the point, Rick, that at some stage the U.S. is going to probably reduce its presence there, and obviously the country's going to have to find its future within the region in terms of gradual integration of the region. Did your findings speak to that as one of the goals for the reconstruction project? Thank you.
You asked a lot of good questions. I'm tempted, why don't I start, and then if others, just raise your hands if you want to jump in on any of these pieces. Thanks for your comments on the inputs versus impact, because that's precisely what we're trying to get to. In terms of the various administration groups that are pulling together data, we have tried to be in touch with those people. We've had a lot of meetings at the Pentagon with some of the people in Afghanistan, and then also the State Department and other places. So we've been trying to get around as much as possible. We have not yet managed to get our own copy of the so-called Piglets report, which is an unclassified but highly data-filled report. We've pleaded, begged, been told it was coming. Get it when you get to Kabul. Get it when you get back to Washington. But we haven't gotten it, so all we've done is been able to sort of read it and then give back the copies of this, and that looks like it's an effort to provide sort of weekly almost information, which I think has been a bit more arduous than advantageous. but I can't really say without having had the fuller look. In terms of co-opting the warlords, I'll start on that one. I think probably Hugh and others and Morgan will have thoughts on it. You're obviously going to end up with some people who did not come from Disney in key jobs, and so I think the guidance is really going to be whether they'll take a vow of sort of change behavior, and so I think there will be some people, and we know for all the data that we've collected, and we've seen reports that from the United Nations, and now with the new report that just came out yesterday, that the naming of names is getting a little bit more aggressive, and the suspicions about a lot of people are really rather well developed and pretty well circulated. The concern that we have gets back to one of our core concerns, which is that in these places data is not only unreliable, but the anecdotes are rumor filled. And so, what do you know to believe? Does that governor have a new car because he is a drug dealer, or does he have a new car because the Japanese have given it to him on the backside, or maybe he's gotten some private funding from some part of our government? So, that then creates a rather confusing environment, and those are all elements of that environment that we're in. So, I think that probably the key, and we, I think, mentioned to some of you, we stayed one night with one of the governors who appears to have a rather checkered reputation based on at least the international information that we've been provided. And he's clearly a very bright and talented and energetic and enthusiastic guy who has the toughest bodyguards you've ever seen in your life. So you just don't know how do you get that guy to go from where he is or has been, because since he was in his teenage years, he was essentially a fighter, to somebody who's now at a stage of development where he could do other things. And so I think it's really critical to see if you can change the behaviors, because some of these people have the energy to go off and found Australia, for example. So we've got to so we have to figure out how we're going to capture that in Afghanistan, and that has to be a fully engaged effort by a lot of people. I think the vetting that has been suggested in this report that came out yesterday is probably a good first step, although vetting, again, is a pretty unreliable way to go, in particular if it's done by the international community, which hasn't shown a great sophistication in picking up these kinds of subtleties, local subtleties. So it's kind of a tough one. We tend to be, I think, a little bit more understanding than absolutist on this, but I do think it's basically, what's your promise for tomorrow, and will you adhere to it? And if you're not, then you're finished. And it needs to be rather dramatic in terms of how that's decided. We do think that Karzai is being looked to take a more forceful role on this from our findings, from the interviews we did.
Just to add on, to build on that, what we did see from our interviews was that Afghans do want criminals brought to justice, war criminals during all the multiple years of fighting, and also they don't like the fact that they're seeing commanders in positions of power. But again, it also is kind of a top-down and bottom-up strategy, whereas I don't know whether a TRC would necessarily be needed in the next year. It's not perhaps an immediate need, but there's certainly undercurrents of tension that remain.
Just one last thing. You asked enough questions that we could probably... we can dismiss the class. On the regional issues, we didn't really get into them as much as we would have liked to. But just anecdotally, it was quite impressive to us to see the markets that we visited and how the goods were coming from really all over, from Dubai, from India. It was also impressive, I think, to us to see how the people we rode around with were quite taken by Indian music and by Indian movie stars and by sort of and there was a frustration that was expressed still with Iran and Pakistan in terms of how they had treated the Afghans when they had been there. Even though many of them had lived there and had become quite comfortable in those places, they still felt as if it had been an exploitive relationship and was continuing that way. So in a way, they were jumping over Pakistan to India. But India's, I think we felt that India's economic glow could be one of the benefits that could obviously pick up Afghanistan as well, but we did not really have a chance to do that.
Gary Thomas, VOA. Given all the data you've collected, can you give us a sense of what the climate is then for the elections that are going to come in September?
In many ways, they're similar to the climate that we found in the run-up to the presidential elections. On the good side, the Afghans are looking forward to them and expressing great enthusiasm to participate. On the bad side, there are the same suspicions that that we found during the run-up to the presidential elections, which is that the commanders, these mid-level guys who still retain illegal militias in the regions, are standing over the ballot boxes, as it were, but also literally, and creating an atmosphere of intimidation. Due to the geography of the country, it's very difficult to provide all the monitors one needs. However, I think with these, I mean, the incredible boost that an election gives a country is kind of worth it. Free and fair, we found in the polls, you were never going to get. This is the first of many. So the Afghans know that it's not free and fair, but they know that many things in their world are not free and fair, and they look forward to kind of slow, gradual improvements.
I would say also that there is fear that there's going to be a lot of intimidation, perhaps from a resurgence of Taliban activity, just because during the presidential elections there was very limited violence, very fortunately, and this time there is a lot more at stake and a lot more. I think the Taliban perhaps sees this as an opportunity to really do some damage. So that's something that people are expecting, but at the same time, we are anticipating a buildup of international forces, NATO increasing their forces by the thousands, and Britain also installing several thousand more permanent forces. So hopefully that will do some good in terms of minimizing potential violence from insurgents.
Thank you for the presentation. Chris Schaefer, CNO Resources. Two questions. One is, when you said 10 years, I was wondering if you could describe that. 10 years of what? Of the same level of sort of support? I may have missed that. Or in terms of donor contribution, or if you could describe that a little bit more. And also, could you talk to the recommendation of paying salaries? I'm wondering if you can give me examples of where this has worked in other countries, and because it has all kinds of other problems along with it, as you know, in terms of inequalities in pay and then spillover and then a dependency and these sorts of things. And I'm wondering why you've decided to gravitate to that and how to get out of that sort of thing, or what other countries this has worked in.
I'm sure nobody else wants to take this one. That's because they're so easy. I think that we really have said 10 years because we're just trying to say it's a long time. And 10 years in our system is a long time. It gets you through a couple presidencies and multiple Congresses. And so it's really to suggest that we've really got to look at this as more than just that even though we think of this as a catalytic effort to really catalyze Afghanistan, you've got to spend 10 years doing it. It's not going to be a 3 or 4 year catalytic period, which you could easily get away with in Iraq if the security situation was established. So in terms of the 10 years, our assumptions that I tried to explain, we're making an assumption that there will be steadily decreasing international assistance. And what we hope there will not be is dramatic drop-offs, unexpected changes, because the Afghans have been very integrally involved in how this was put together. And so their own internal budgets show that there will be less of certain kinds of money and more lending and other pieces. So they've got a pretty good balanced sense of it. But that's the core assumption that we're working on, is there'll be less and less funding, and that's why we make the argument it's got to be more and more focused and more targeted, because in this initial period, the emergency period and the war period, we don't have anywhere near as much trouble throwing money at the problem. And now we're going to spend a period where everybody's going to be saying, how's that money being spent? You did what? That governor took how much? And so you're going to get that discussion is going to become more a part of our public debate here. And that will in turn create a chilling atmosphere for what has to be a very steady process, even though it's going to be a downward slide. So that's the way we're thinking of it strategically. In terms of paying salaries, nobody likes doing it. Congress hates doing it, although we are, as I said, we're paying the ANA. And it's not a perfect choice, but we don't believe from our visits and our interviews, going to newly constructed women's centers, seeing a new clinic being built, seeing a courthouse up on a hill, that the people who are supposed to be in these places and make them work are going to be able to be there if we depend on the central government in its infancy to figure out a way to be able to work all of these elements. Now, we'd like it to happen, but we think that there's going to be that if the government runs out of money, as it's probably going to, because it's not as if the budget that they have crafted is going to end up working, as the paper suggests. I mean, you can expect many, many complications. That generally what happens when the money runs out is it sticks to the center and it doesn't get out to the people. And so what we're saying is make sure that that becomes a priority, but also because we're worried about the international community and the Afghans telling us that too much is being done through internationals, and the international community reacting by saying there is an absorptive capacity problem here. And we're saying there may be an absorptive capacity problem, but in fact if you pay the police, you pay the judges, you pay the teachers, they're going to be able to do an awful lot that the international community cannot do. It's because we're not going to get out there, because there's going to be danger, because these are not jobs we should be doing. So it's not a perfect solution by a long shot, and I'm sure I will run into some development traditionalists who will question this even further. I'm actually looking forward to the discussion, because we recognize that it is a point of possible contention. But we also don't think, we think that if you don't do this, that you won't make the 10-year mark. So, again, this plan is built on getting to a point in 10 years where things can maybe go on their own. That's our viable zone up here, is that the local people have a shot of making it on their own. That's what we're hoping for. Not that they're totally successful yet, but they have a shot at making it on their own. So I hope that answers your question.
Frank Kennefeck, Chemonics International. We desperately need the baseline data. I'm anxious to see the report come out, because we're not clear where the reference point is, and we're going to need that as we go forward. At the same time, I'm a little concerned that you've tiptoed around several very basic points, one of which is the model the donors have used to implement the program so far. I would probably figure 95% of the Afghans object to it, and I personally do too, being part of the donor community. Using the NGO, PVO community and completely bypassing the government is not workable, and it's not efficient, and it's not going to get us there. Mm-hmm. By the same token, I think the U.S. and the foreign military presence there is not using the correct model. We have models from the history books that are successful, and they're not paying attention to them. Bringing in thousands of more troops to secure the election is not the answer. Neither is chasing the shadow Mullah Omar over the hills. And I certainly wouldn't recommend your securing the four border points as being the key areas for the way forward. There are models out there, and I hope we can have an open discussion about them. Thank you.
I think that we are probably rather well aligned on the need to move from the present model to finding ways of getting assistance more directly to the local people. We've tried to suggest a few ways of doing that, and I think we'd agree with you wholeheartedly. In terms of the better military models, we'd welcome your comments, and would like to hear more from you. I think that our feeling is that the international military presence up to now has provided the surprise dimension that has provided probably a higher level of security than people, certainly a higher level of security than people have enjoyed for some time. Whether it's being excessively directed at chasing shadows. I think that's something that we didn't really have a chance to get a very deep understanding of. We didn't get certainly a personal exposure to that. So we'd like to hear any suggestions. We'd be happy to be part of that discussion.
On the first point, I think through our data we found that programs that were funded by the Afghanistan Reconstruction Trust Fund, which is a fund that donors can contribute to, which is then the money is allotted to different things according to government priorities. So the government of Afghanistan actually has decisions on how that money is spent. We've seen programs run through that as working particularly well, particularly the National Solidarity Program, which provides block grants to villages. So villages can come up with, their communities come together, they decide what project they want to build. I think it's up to $20,000 or $25,000 for this block grant. They apply to the central government, and the central government gives them that money, and then the villages can actually build that. So the reconstruction hits the villages, bypasses corrupt officials, things like that. So we've seen that as being particularly helpful. Hugh may have some other opinions on the NSP.
No, I think that covers it. But I'd like to raise this whole NGO debate is a fascinating one. I mean, the Afghans engage with the assistance debate more than any other nation, I think, that I've seen. But actually, when you think about it, the NGOs are just receiving money that the donors are giving, and the problem is with the donors making the choice to fund NGOs directly rather than funding NGOs through the government, which is what the government is requesting. That would be, so really it's a bit of a false argument. The problem is that the demand for implementation capacity as a result of the supply of donor money is not being met by a supply of local private sector actors who are instead registering as NGOs to take advantage of the favorable regulatory environment that NGOs face in the country. Fixing that should be quite technocratic and central, which would result hopefully in a better environment for the private sector to come up and meet this, provide implementation supply.
Just on the military piece quickly, there's a clear preference for building indigenous capacity on the military piece. And our point about the numbers coming up has nothing to do with our recommendation to bring the numbers up the election. That's just what we anticipate and what the numbers look like. But clearly, the critical point here in my mind is that any reduction of the forces ought to be based on some rational decision rather than fatigue. And I guess the fear is, and I think this goes to the question that was asked earlier, too, about the 10 years, is that there's a natural tendency for fatigue to take over rather than some rational basis. So that's my only point.
Good afternoon. Rick, just want to thank you and your team for this excellent bit of research. Very much appreciate it. It's very welcomed, I think, in the larger discourse over Afghanistan and where it needs to head in the future. I work with Mercy Corps. My name is George Devendorf, and I wasn't going to raise an NGO-related issue, but since it was brought to the floor, I just want to really thank the panel for its at least attempts to clarify the NGO's role in the current overall development picture, because I think that's one that has been subject to a great deal of misrepresentation for various reasons, and won't go into it here, but anyway, simply to say that I think there are viable roles not only for international NGOs, but of course for Afghan NGOs as well, looking forward. And towards that end, recently, after several months of back and forth, a fairly helpful bit of legislation which will help govern the NGO sector appears to have been ironed out, which, among other things, will help to reduce the NGO role from somewhere around 2,400 organizations in country to more like 400 or 500, again, helping to separate out business interests from non-governmental humanitarian interests. To my question. You all mentioned in the governance sector that, in general, you found that there was a high degree of acceptance or support for Karzai and central government, if not the reality, at least the concept. And I'm just curious, in your studies, did you find significant geographic differences in those levels of support? And then secondly, relating to that, Rick, I think you mentioned that the central government needs to be seen as credible. But that we shouldn't expect too much out of it in the way of capacity. Insofar as it can focus in the next few years on a few particular issues. I wonder what your study points you towards in terms of key priorities, knowing that already in the recent Afghan Development Forum, President Karzai himself mentioned that his two greatest priorities, at least for in terms of development, were infrastructure and human development, human capacity within the Afghan population, which very much seems to validate your findings. If he could add one or two other things to that short list, I'm just curious what your study would point to. Thanks.
I can certainly speak to the last part of the question. I don't know, on the ratings, mm-hmm, if you want to do that. Why don't I just take the last part first? I think we felt that in terms of making the central government more credible, that they should really focus primarily in the water issue, because we think the water question really has so much relevance. I mean, it has health relevance, it has economic efficiency relevance, and it has food and economic relevance. So it can be used so many different ways. We think it probably needs to be, a hierarchy needs to be set up that takes advantage of a lot of multiple micro projects for dams and whatnot, but then also restore some of the existing facilities that were there before. And probably it will need to be supplemented by lots of small generators and whatnot. But so we're really looking, we think that that's, we just think there's great potential for water to be used more intelligently in a lot of different levels. And it could really move Afghanistan into another time, into another century, which is really what you're talking about here in some parts of the country. The second thing that we really focused on was probably literacy, in particular for young people and for women. Although I think if you take, we assume that the country, at least half the country, is under 18. It's again hard to tell because the data doesn't exist, but you've got to get the baseline of the population up to a point where it's able to do more and take on more challenges, and that's a good national kind of initiative. That's the sort of initiative that a government can undertake and can very quickly produce results. We've seen that in many, many places around the world. So those are to be two specifics that we would suggest that might be enriching in that, in terms of giving the central government something that it can really lead and can also produce on. And again, when you take on these national initiatives, you want to be able to deliver. You don't want, you can't just keep putting promises out, because the credibility of this government is not that deep, because people don't have that much experience, and so we ran into a lot of people saying, "Oh, I voted for him, so I expect this." And we didn't think the expectations were too huge, but there was that very quick, "My vote should mean something," which there's not a lot of maturity in that kind of a judgment. So you have to have tangible benefits coming along.
Ray Jennings, Creative Associates in the World Bank. I had two questions. The first has to do with what you just mentioned, which on the face of it appears to be a very positive finding, which is people's sense that the central government has some relevance to them, even if there's very little service delivery going on. Historically, Kabul has never been able to deliver outside of the immediate capital area. But I wonder if you were able to differentiate between how people felt about Karzai and how people felt about the central government, because there is a big difference. And one of the challenges I think we all see is that Karzai has maybe 3 years left to transfer the legitimacy he has and he carries to the central government. Because if you had asked the question of an Afghan central government divorced from Karzai, I wonder what kind of answer you would have got. So I wonder if you could nuance that a little bit, and in your interviews, whether you differentiated that in any way. And the other question has to do with these folks you have trained that you mentioned in your presentation, who were vital to your project. Now, that's a nice base of human and social capital that you've built, who helped you do this project. Any plans for having them continue this project, or any way they can continue to engage in helping collect data or work on the election? What kind of plans do you think you could develop for them?
You want to take a stab at the first? Certainly the point about Karzai being divorced from the central government is a very good one. When we talked to Afghans, overwhelmingly, when they thought of the central government, they thought of Karzai. We were able to glean a little bit from some of the interviews when we were able to differentiate between the two, and they did see that the central government ministries were weak, that some people who worked in the ministries are susceptible to bribery, things like that. But the local government was much more palpable to them. They see it day to day, and so that was one of the reasons why we have a bit more of a negative result for local government than we do for national. I think that maybe in future incarnations of this report, hopefully we can get at that question a little bit better. In terms of the...
Just a quick note on that. I didn't go to Afghanistan, disclaimer. But I watched the results come in, and one of the things that occurred to me was that the distinction between government and participation. We were kind of looking at our governance and participation results, and I kept asking myself, well, gee, they really don't think much of the services that are getting delivered. Why are they so happy with the government, federal or otherwise, or national or otherwise? And the answer was clearly the participation in my mind. They liked the fact that they got to participate, and Karzai was the embodiment of their participation. So just to drill that down a little bit.
I think that's really good. I would add that where the nuance is starting to show up is where people see the central, have begun to look down into the central government more. And so in Kabul, you're starting to get some of that nuance in our conversations of what ministries are not delivering and who. So you're getting that, but I didn't see much that suggested that we're picking up that kind of interpretive look at the central government yet outside.
Those results are mostly from Kabul, but that would make sense because of the proximity. And then as to the interviewers, we worked with SIAR and Media and Communication to do the interviews. And some of these interviewers were people that SIARA had used previously, but they also went out and recruited new interviewers. So they were people who had not done this before, were completely new to it. If you look at our Voices of a New Afghanistan report, which I believe is also available outside, but it's available online, we give a mini bio of each of the interviewers, and one of them was a commander, another one was a teacher, things like that. So hopefully giving them new new opportunities. I don't know. Perhaps SIAR will use them again, but they all talk about how they've had this training, and so hopefully that will help them secure other jobs in country.
I mean, it's really a great challenge, and we'd love to, probably the way we'd like to get back to this, and we've suggested before that the best use of this kind of a product is to do it again in 6 months or do it again in a year, because then you really are developing an index. You can actually say it's a quality of life index or it's a Dow Jones or whatever it happens to be. And so we'd be happy to go back to these people just as we'd be happy to go back to the people in Iraq, because in both cases, they took huge pride in this work. They just absolutely felt as if they were connected to something important in their country, and that in turn energized us. When we did the training, the people who've been involved directly with them from our project have really found that inspiring, and they in turn liked the fact that they would actually go out and talk to their fellow citizens. It wasn't without complications. If some of you who've been at earlier meetings heard that we had a little problem in Kandahar, and two of our interviewers were apprehended by the police, and whereupon one turned on the other, and then the other turned on the other, and they would, one wasn't from the region, and so we got a nice little sort of drama of what actually is happening in the country. And of course one of the interviewers then spent some time in prison and wasn't treated all that well, so we got to see another piece of it. So we wish we could honor these people a little bit more the way you suggest, Ray, and be happy to recommend them to anybody who might want to call upon them as well. Ray helped us find the interviewers in Iraq through USIP and through Sloan Mann, and that was really very helpful.
Could I just, on the vulnerability to Karzai, the Karzai exposure, kind of what's going to happen if he's assassinated, what's going to happen when he steps down? It's becoming less of a problem as the constitution gets enacted gradually, and I think although that's not going to solve the problem completely, the parliamentary elections are the culminating part of the bond process, and a really vital part of the constitution now. And I think if they go well, and if the capacity of the parliament to oversee the legislative process is built, then that's going to minimize that vulnerability.
Hi. Greg Pollock from the International Crisis Group. And two quick questions. From the map that you put up earlier with the various regions in mind, we can glean certain conclusions about how progress is being perceived among the various ethnic groups. But I was wondering if you could go into a bit more depth about, in your interviews, how the progress is being perceived among Hazaras, Uzbeks, Pashtuns, etc. And then secondly, does your report address the drug issue and put forward any kind of alternative to the current eradication strategy?
As to ethnic differences, we did not specifically look at that. We did just focus on regional areas. So I would probably limit my interpretation of ethnic differences to the fact that there was, as I was mentioning to Stuart, a continuing undercurrent of some ethnic tension. Overwhelmingly, Afghans we talked to said, oh, well, that happened in the past, and now, you know, Tajiks and Hazaras are living together as one. So the interviews are now quite positive, but I think that there's still something there that still needs to be dealt with. And then I think regionally probably the best way to look at the different ethnic breakdowns. But again, you know, Karzai is seen as a pretty unifying figure that transcends these ethnic boundaries. And he is receiving criticism from both sides, you know, Pashtuns saying that he doesn't have enough Pashtuns in the government, and Tajiks and Hazara and Uzbek saying that he has, you know, doesn't have enough, of course. So I think you're still going to have that struggle for years to come.
In terms of the drug question, we're going to try to do over the next month, we did a number of additional sort of research pieces that don't all fit in conveniently to this particular report. So we're going to try to produce a number of supplements that will take on some of these issues that we did additional research on in the local government paper. And one that we will do is on the drug issue. I think that among the many concerns is that we have a rather large initiative underway in terms of dealing with this, with the poppy growth and the distribution and the all the elements of the trade. But we're very, very, very uncomfortable with the way this issue is shaped. It tends to be described as a 1.5 to 2 point something billion dollar problem. It's unclear, although it seems to us that that's based on street value in a Western city as opposed to the value in the marketplace. So right away you have a problem that's been a bit hyped by our own industries. We have a lot of pieces in place here in our government, both financing and arrangements to address this problem. But most of the plans speak to about a $750 million initiative from the U.S. budget side. And the problem in country, if you accept the number that was in the New York Times op-ed this past week, she described it as a $600 million issue inside of Afghanistan. So there you already start to wonder, well, if you had $750 million, what does that do for a $600 million problem? And could you, in fact, address it in a more intelligent way, in light of the fact that what we've typically done in other places has yet to be proven successful, whether it's alternative crops, or whether it's interdiction, or whether it's a military solution to it. So I think many of the questions that are being asked are questions that we have, but we really didn't come down with a solution yet because it's a rather, rather large problem that we haven't had the opportunity to fully indulge in. But our suspicion is that it's we're working off of highly unreliable numbers. For example, you may have seen the story in the Washington Post last week, and it asked how many acres of crops had been eradicated, and the local governor said 7,600 acres. And then they said, well, that's the total number of acreage in your region. That's quite surprising. And so then the next number that was offered was 6,000 acres. And then they went to the central office in Kabul and they said, well, actually, nationally we're at 450 acres, and that would mean that in Khost we're at 320 acres. So the difference between 320 and 7,600 is significant. And when you have that kind of data, what do you measure your performance on or your strategy on? And that's the kind of thing that's fairly representative of working not only on this issue but on other issues in Afghanistan. So I'm sure I've added more questions to your question, but we're going to try to provide some of that. Actually, Mike Arrows, who I was introduced before, but he went upstairs to get his jacket on, is standing back here, and he's the one who's working on that particular issue for us.
Why don't we take, I know we have one last question here, I think, and I've dealt with it already. Why don't you take the microphone, too, if you...
As I work for Voice of America, I do hear progress.
But the people can't hear you. Can you mind holding the microphone? Just so people can hear you?
Yeah, thank you. Well, working at Voice of America and being with the rest of you in the city, especially Washington, with the passage of time, the concern is growing that lots of money is going to Afghanistan, but less is being taken back. Input and output does not match very much. 2 days ago, I had a talk with somebody high-ranking in a talk show in Afghanistan, and he said more than $11 million was spent, he said. And he said, we just have the receipt of $700 million. Now, what I'm saying is everything was prepared at the beginning in Washington, then it was applied in Bonn, the first gathering, and they had the picture of Afghanistan, everybody, including Zalmay Khalilzad, the ambassador of America until lately in Afghanistan, and all the experts in Afghanistan. So they understood what kind of field of burden and gravity will everybody face in Afghanistan. Now, with the experience that we all have accumulated and seen in Afghanistan, to what extent do you think, sir, looking from the point of view of State Department, Pentagon, those who are planning for Afghanistan, do they think that the way which has been followed up till now has been a sound way for Afghanistan? You have talked about holes and spots in this evaluation of yours, which I thank you, and I should have thanked you at the beginning. This dispersion which everybody sees in Afghanistan, and the questions that I see tackles bits and points here and there, and you give it a 10 years just to make it sound coherent for progress to be achieved in 10 years. Now, look, coming back to my question, the thing I'm trying to say is how much globally, coherently, is the question of Afghanistan being seen in Washington so that the results should be more sooner, not waste of time as it was in the last 3.5 years. And my last point, how much effort is going to give a boost to the government of President Karzai, especially with this constitution that my friend Mr. Hugh Ridley suggested, and I don't agree with him. The constitution was made to bring a presidential system, a strong president in Afghanistan. In the lower go where the constitution was accepted, there was a lots of efforts, those who have carried the Afghanistan story, to balance that with a sort of parliamentary regime. Now you will see that that presidential system in the constitution does not apply anymore on the text of it. Forget the practice of it, which will be after September. A presidential system with the parliamentary notions and principles inserted inside that constitution. So I'm taking your time, sorry. So I'm concerned how much coherence is going in the effort now and in the year to come, and how much effort is shown for the reinforcement of Afghanistan as it was forced in Bonn to make all these efforts in Afghanistan go in a very coherent, rational way. I see a dispersion. Sorry.
I think it's. I think there has been a surprising coherence over the past 3 years. I mean, it's been, again, you're bringing a lot of different players in, and they're all generally doing their approaching the problem from their traditional view and from their industry model. But I think there has been considerable coherence, some of it driven by the Afghans on the ground, and their insistence on a lot actually has been, I think, really instructive. I do think that we're probably at a delicate point here because you are transitioning into a different period where you will have a different kind of military involvement, and you won't have this the same kind of impression made by the Department of Defense. You will end up, you still go back to a State Department that isn't really well structured for these kinds of cases. AID has some capacity in this area, but it's really a bit, it's still under developed in terms of taking on these kinds of challenges. So I think that, and then you don't have that singular leadership within the U.S. government that's probably going to hold it together. When Afghanistan was at the center of the picture, it naturally, I think, was an easier one to bring some coherence to. Now it's really not anywhere near as much a focus of U.S. attention. And so that dispersion is something that I think the Afghans, when we had President Karzai here, that seemed to me that was his central message. That was maybe 8, 9 months ago. I suspect that it's even a bigger message for him today. So I think you're voicing probably a central concern, at least of the Afghan leadership that has enjoyed the support that they've had up to this point and are a little worried about being orphaned. I think your point on the Constitution probably stands as a good contribution. Thank you all very much. We appreciate having you here, and we hope that you'll go to the website and look for the report, which, and the executive summary apparently is waiting for you as you leave, and the publication will be available shortly. So there should be plenty for you to read in the next few days. Thank you very much.